Okay, today I'm in the Lake District with Martin Julian. Thank you very much for agreeing to talk to us, Martin.
Thank you for coming all this way.
That is my pleasure. Basically, could you just describe your involvement, your occupation in racing?
I'm not a tipster. I loathe the word. I'm an analyst of horse racing matters, an author, a publisher, a journalist, but I would say basically an analyst more than anything else.
Okay, so we're in the Lake District now, but you were born in Yorkshire and then moved down south for school. Can you tell us a bit about your childhood?
Yes, I was born in the early 50s in a mining community in Leeds, where my father was a clergyman. And it was his first living, and it was fairly tough. I was a vicar's son, and I was, as I am now, quite tall, so I was a target for the local gangs. And there was a guy called Tom Black who used to hang out waiting for me, and so I used to have to circumnavigate my way home through different routes and round corners and nooks and crannies and ginnels, as they call them up here. And I think that's where I developed my interest in racing from, having to think round corners. And so that's where I started. And I went to school at a place called Chapeltown, which was fairly notorious as well. And then I was moved to a private school, which was a massive culture shock, in Hove in Sussex, thanks to the support of a great uncle. And I was the only boy in the school with a Yorkshire accent. There were 70 boys in the boarding school, and I was the only one, and they got me to say things, and rather like those Smurf adverts where they fall over backwards kicking their legs in the air, these posh lads used to do that whenever I said bath instead of bath and path instead of path, and they never heard an accent like it before. So so it was one extreme to the other.
But little do they know that you're the reason you were able to go there. Your uncle was one of the founders of the NHS. They should have been a bit more respectful, shouldn't they?
Well, Sir Ivor Julian commanded a great deal of respect, and the headmaster was a guy called Edward Snell, and he knew that I came from the poor side of town, and all the others came from affluent backgrounds, all the other boys, and he had a word with my uncle, who is a local celebrity in Hove, Sir Ivor Julian, and said, "Look, Martin's feeling a bit left out of things. What can we do about it?" And Sir Ivor said, "I'll sort it out." So he turned up one Sunday and timed his arrival. He came in his Rolls Royce and timed his arrival to coincide with as we all made our way back from the church, and made sure that the Rolls Royce arrived just as all the boys were looking, all the 70 boys were looking. And he called out, he's got his chauffeur to call out, "I've come to collect Martin Julian." And I had to walk out in front of him. From that moment, I was of equal status with the others. He was a wonderful man, very supportive. And then did the same for my brother, supported him as well, who also had a similar background, Leeds and then Hove in Sussex.
So I assume that some of the boys coming from more affluent backgrounds had a bit of racing background. Is that anything to do with your the spark and the interest of racing?
We went to a Brighton racecourse once with some of the boys, but no, my racing was fairly dormant until my later education at my secondary school, at my other school, St John's Leatherhead. When I was one of the boys' fathers decided to take us to Epsom to Coronation Cup Day, and we saw Park Top running and it was in the middle, and that's when I fell in love with racing, because I was tall, totally lacking self-belief and confidence. And I saw Lester Piggott coming up on the outside in a small field, looking over his left shoulder, looking over his right shoulder with utter disdain, letting out an inch of rein and just winning effortlessly on this wonderful mare. And I was totally bewitched and entranced and enamoured of it. I thought, I've never seen anyone with such confidence. I just wish I could have one tiny, tiny proportion of the same degree of self-belief as he did. and I became a massive fan of Lester Pigott, massive fan, and backed him in doubles and trebles wherever he went. And that's while I was at school, so it was pretty illegal because I was underage and missing lessons to get to the betting shop at Leatherhead with William Hills.
So were you making it pay in those days?
The pocket money for the whole term was £2, and I won 32 and 6, which was enough to buy an album, and I bought Blonde on Blonde by Bob Dylan. So I doubled the capital allowance that we all had, and yes, I did make it pay, and it was wonderful, wonderful, going into a betting shop and having a sixpence Yankee or whatever, and seeing Lester Pigott clicking on all these lovely David Robinson horses. Bruce Raymond, he was another jockey, was lucky for me. Yeah, wonderful days, wonderful days.
So moving forward, you went to university, and then I was quite surprised to see that your first actual, not tipping, but advisory, was Greyhounds. So how did that come about?
Well, I couldn't get to a race course. I was at King's College in London. I couldn't get to a race course, and it was quite a long journey to get anywhere, and we had no money. There was no money. My friends and I had no money. So I decided to go to Hackney Dog Stadium on one occasion. And I just thought it was, some of the characters there were wonderful. I mean, they were obviously, it was quite sparsely attended. But it was wonderful just seeing these greyhounds. I love them as animals. I was very taken by them as physically, their physiques and their elegance and their beauty. And I just got to know that certain dogs weren't going to win and other dogs were expected to win. And I studied it, spoke to a few people and thought, well, I can probably make this game pay. So I had a few bets, and then I thought, well, I can make it pay a little further by advising people what dogs to back. So yes, I started following dog racing, and I got to know my dogs, and I got to know a few things about the dog game, you know, when a bitch comes in and out of season and stuff like that. And the first dog I ever tipped was called Chalk's Monkey. My wife was having her wisdom teeth out, and I was meant to be there to support her because she was under anaesthetic, and she woke up and I'd gone, because I'd made it to Hackney Dogs to see Chalk's Monkey win by 6 lengths, which is a long way for a dog to win. And he won a 5-1, and I'd advertised it to my clients as a potential tip. I'd had £14 in the world, and I spent £7 on an advertisement in a publication called The Handicap Book. And I got £15 back. £16 back. 8 people sent me £2 each for the name of this dog, and it was Chalk's Monkey. And I got £32 back. And in those days, a good holiday job paid you £12 a week, to give you some idea of the attraction of that business suddenly.
You're making it sound quite easy, but you must have put in some work before you got to that point. You know, you say you sort of studied about bitches in season, that sort of thing. I mean, how much analysis did you do before you became confident enough to sort of start betting or tipping, or not tipping, giving analysis?
With the dogs, I didn't do that much, because it was a question of knowing the dogs and getting out there and speaking to people, and the form was secondary. When I, 2 years later, turned to horse racing, I devoted hours and hours to it, but of course most of those hours were spent on the road, because there were no specialist TV channels in those days. So I thought nothing of getting in the train to go to a race meeting to see one horse and then coming back. And so it was a lot of time devoted to travelling, and form books went everywhere with me, and the Sporting Chronicle and Sporting Life, I couldn't really afford them. They were quite dear. Sporting Life was sixpence, I remember, and it was a struggle to find the money to pay for that.
Okay, were there, do you have any sort of early mentors, anybody that marched your card a bit about where to start with the racing form?
Well, I wrote to, when I wanted to get into racing while I was at university, I wrote to Len Thomas and Peter Scott of the Telegraph, and Peter O'Sullivan, of course, and Clive Graham. And Clive Graham wrote back saying, thank you for your letter. There are 320 holders of the press badge and you're unlikely to be the 321st. So it wasn't very encouraging. But the one man who became a mentor was Bruff Scott, who I love to bits. I mean, he gave me the support and he opened doors for me and encouraged me and got me to meet him at the races. The first time he asked me to meet him, he was covering York for ITV 7 days. And I got in a train and went all the way up to see him, and I'd spent as much money as I had. I had very little money in those days. And I went to York and I saw him briefly and he said, I'm sorry, I'm too busy, I can't see you now. So I had to get in the train and go all the way back without having managed to spend as much time talking to him as I would have liked. But then I got to meet him again and things went on from there with the Sunday Times job and stuff, which came a couple of years later. But Bruff was hugely supportive. Supportive of me in every way.
Okay, but before we go to that, I want to talk a bit more about your advisory, SRAS, that you started. Now, you told me that 6 to 10 advices a year you used to give. Now, that is very, very selective. What was your selection method for that? Do you want to tell us that secret?
Well, there were only 6 to 10 selections a year because, firstly, I was very conscious that I was giving advices to people and they were putting money on, and I used to lose sleep over it. It was nerve-wracking and stressful and difficult to handle emotionally for me. I mean, my father was a vicar, my mother's a nurse. I come from a vocational background. I don't come from a hard-hitting business background. So things were quite difficult for me. So I couldn't stand the stress of giving more than that. And the other thing is I had to wait till everything was right. And I had five or six factors that had to be together. I mean, I stayed. One trainer who was very lucky for me was Michael Jarvis. I focused very much on Michael Jarvis's horses. Bruce Raymond, as the jockey, was lucky for me. But I was a keen follower of speed figures. There weren't speed figures in those days, but I looked at comparable times. I looked at the Sporting Life used to publish Gallup reports in those days. So the Weekender still does them, but they're not as full as they used to be. But the Sporting Life used to publish Gallup reports. So I looked at which horses had galloped with which horse. And if one of those horses had seen galloped with a horse of superior class, then I took it as a tip, hint. That's how I found Just Revenge, the very first tip I gave, which won at Doncaster, beat an odds-on shot of Jeff Rags with Pat Edery riding Just Revenge. And I trained by Atty Corbett many years ago. And I saw the horse had worked with a superior horse, and it was a once race maiden, Just Revenge, with just a naught next to its name. So I tipped it and it won a 15-2 at Doncaster in a maiden. And it was beautifully unexposed and the clients loved it and assumed it was inside information. So I used... Everything I used was available. Virtually everything I used was available to anyone else. I didn't have any privileged access or information. And I don't recall speaking to... any specific trainers until much later than that. I was too nervous to go up to them.
So your first selection that you gave as an advisor... One, so you've hit the ground running. Your clients must have been the patient type, but I understand you ran several advisory services under different names. Now, why would you do that?
Well, it's easy to say because I wanted to do multiple tipping and cover all angles and make sure that I never tipped two horses in the same race, by the way. I drew the line at that. But I was very keen, from a psychological point of view, to accommodate the different characters that existed in the betting community. So I thought of some names, and I said to a friend of mine at university, I said, I want a name of a Ted Moult-type character. Many of your clients won't be familiar with Ted Moult, but he was a sort of do-it-yourself man. and I want a rock solid, no nonsense, no bullshit northerner. He said, I want a name that encompasses this, encapsulates this, the essence of this character. And he said, I know one, George Mould, M-O-U-L-D, George Mould. That's a great solid name. And I said, okay, now I want someone who's a car mechanic in Newmarket who gets his information because he tinkers around with trainers' cars and jockeys' cars, and they give him tips every so often. He said, oh yeah, I've got his name, Tim Hoskins. That's Tim. I said, okay, now I want a company name which has a solid feel to it. So we thought of PSB, Professional Sporting Bureau, which still exists to this day. And then I said, I want someone in the West Country who gets West Country horses. And I want a name that encompasses that. He said, oh, Avon Racing. So I was obviously quite privileged to be quite well educated, and I loathe saying this, but when I wrote George Mould letters, I took out an accommodation address in Newcastle, 14A Pilgrim Street. I never went there in my life, but I wrote letters on cheap blue paper. And then in those days you had a stencil and you had to put it in a machine and turn it round, and I used to do that to the early hours, put it in a box, send it to Data Post, made sure that it went up to Newcastle. All the letters went out with the Newcastle postmark. And I used to make sure I deliberately made spelling mistakes and punctuation mistakes in George's letter so nobody would think it was Martin Julian. And then Avon Racing concentrated on West. Tim Hoskins concentrated on Newmarket. I had six or seven names, and the publication called The Handicap Book, they had one, sometimes they had 20 advertisements. 10 of them were mine, and 10 of them were a wonderful man called John Blake, who traded under the name of Martin Wells, Captain Alan Carfax, Ryan Hartley, and a few other names as well.
He got a few quid off me, Ryan Hartley.
Well, yeah, well... Well, now he was not... John Blake became a mentor figure as well, and he used to phone up and saying, I must speak to the man who can punctuate his letters, because John Blake didn't really, and he lived down in Hampshire. And I stayed with him a few times, and I was in awe of him when he started. But as I say, the Handicap Book had 20, 30 advertisements, and most of them were monopolised by John or myself. And the joke about George Mould was that even to this day, as recently as last summer, in Presso's in Newmarket, I had someone come up to me and said, George Mould was the best tipster he ever met, and he didn't know it was me. I've still got clients who come up to me, and I had on one occasion many, many years ago, somebody said they'd had a meal with George Mould, and they went on about what a wonderful man he was, and they weren't aware of the fact it was actually me, because I don't really look like a George, and I certainly don't look like a George Mould.
So you had a lot of fun doing this, but the serious bit, I mean, did they make a few quid?
George Mould couldn't tip a loser. Paul Hemmings couldn't tip a winner. Avon Racing struggled. Tim Hoskins was good because I went for horses that were Newmarket, from top Newmarket yards. Henry Cecil started off. Luca Kamani was a good friend. Not in those days, but I got to know Luca very well. And so I had favourite trainers, and of course Michael Jarvis. But yeah, George Mould concentrated on northern horses, and Peter Easterby. John Joe was starting to ride for Peter Easterby, and Alan Brown was the super sub. And on one season, I gave 32 selections, 27 won. 27 of them won. It was George Mould. That's when Peter Easterby had a strike rate of about 40-50%. And I just had no information to speak of. I just simply followed Peter Easterby. And when I noticed when he had a horse that won, they built up sequences, and they were sort of 7-4, 6-4, weren't that great prices, but it was a wonderful magic coming together, because we had John Joe O'Neill and Easterby together. So John Joe was on the app, Easterby couldn't train a loser. And I actually went up to see him on one occasion, and there was Night Nurse, Sea Pigeon, Little Owl, Starfen. There were some great horses all together in the box lined up together. I went to see him. Got a train to go and see him specially, and that was one of the great days of my life.
Right, so when you decided to go down the, in inverted commas, more respectable route of of journalism, did all these guys shuffle off to the to wherever great tipsters go when they finish tipping?
We kept George going for a little while because he had such a good following. There were quite a f- there's a, I won't mention his name, but there was one well-known actor who actually went knocking at 14A Pilgrim Street, wanted to take George out for a meal because he'd done so well. It was actually, I can tell you now, because he's gone, Tony Booth from Till Death Us Do Part, who became a good friend. And when he discovered, he insisted on meeting George Mould, and I had to say, well, I'm afraid your George Mould doesn't exist. Martin Julian exists, and he's George Mould. But he got to know me quite well, Tony Booth. And so we kept George going for a while, and PSB became the publishing side of my respectable side of my business. I started writing books because it was less pressure, so that's how Dark Horses started, really.
Okay, now Dark Horses must have been quite difficult as a fairly unknown person to sort of start gaining access and to get your card marked about these potential good things lurking in stables. How did you manage it?
Well, tried and tested systems. There were systems. I didn't speak to trainers. I hardly ever spoke to trainers. What I relied on was, more than anything, the entry system. Because in those days, there were advanced entries. It's not like nowadays where Derby horses are entered for the Derby as yearlings. They're meaningless Derby entries. But the one thing about the entry system is, in those days, there was a three-week, there was a racing calendar, and the entries were made, can you believe, it sounds inconceivable these days, but the entries were made 3 weeks before for a particular race. I don't think there was a late entry system, and there wasn't a supplementary system. So what I used to do is I used to see horses that were entered as two-year-olds in advance for specifically good races, for Group 1 races, and I just assumed that they were had been working well enough to justify having that entry. It was all fairly obvious, really. And for once-raced horses, I used my own judgment. I looked at times of maidens, and if the Westley Maiden was running a specifically good time, or the Haynes Hanson and Clark, or one of the... I compared comparable times with divisions. So for the once-raced ones, I went by pedigrees and things like that, horses running over too short a trip, the same old system you use nowadays. But it was mainly through to the entry system that I found the dark horses.
Okay. And then the Professional Sporting Bureau, you set up to publish your work. Now, was that because you were having a problem to get somebody to publish it, or was it just to cut the middleman out and maximise any potential profits there?
I didn't actually look for a publisher. We're talking about the time now in my mid-20s when I'd started the tipping services basically to manage to enable me, support me in my research books for reading theology. The theology books I had were quite expensive, and there was a higher incidence of theft, can you believe, in the theology faculty, University of King's College library, than any other faculty in the university. These, I should hasten to add, are people who are going to enter the Church of England, but they were nicking books left, right and centre, so I couldn't get hold of the books I needed on 19th century German Protestant theology and stuff. So I started the dog service to try to enable me to a library, which I still have to this day, of theology books. And so when it came to publishing my own books, by that time I'd had the job with the Sunday Times. Bruff Scott needed some help. He did the feature writing, but he was looking for somebody to do some advisory work, advise horses for the forthcoming week, writing on a Sunday about the big racing coming up, which is now done all over the place, but in those days was quite unusual. So the lovely man called John Lovesey was the sports editor of the Sunday Times, and he asked me to write a column. So I wrote a column which was entitled Warm Up, which became very, very popular indeed. And that attracted such a following that he allowed me to, when I published a book, I published it myself. When I published it, I was able to give a little footnote and a little mention of the book at the foot of the column. And I was staggered by the number of people who wanted to buy the book. So although I was keen to find a publisher, because of the success of my own personal following with the Sunday Times and also with my increased size of my mailing list, it became better to be independent. So I remained independent. There was a time years later when the Racing Post published my books and Heinemann Kingswood have published my books. But generally speaking, I like my independence
and
editorial control.
Okay, sorry. So how was your personal punting going at the time? Was it a big factor?
Over 50 years, I've struggled a little with the personal side of punting, because when I'm looking at a race, I want to look if it's 20 runner handicap or 20 runner novice. I want to look at every horse. And if I got a personal interest, I can't help but be drawn towards the horse I've backed. I've got to focus. So I do have bets because I need to feel the same pain as my clients if they lose. I like to be at the receiving end. For instance, all the stuff I send out, I like to receive it myself, because having written it, you get a totally different feeling when you open the envelope in the morning or you look at the download nowadays on the internet. So the personal punting, it's a different... I asked Luca Kamani once when we had tea together. I have tea with Luca quite a bit when he's about. And I said to him, look, you're in a position here where you could actually have a bet based on inside information. And I've been in that situation as well as an owner. I said, why don't you do it? And he summed it up perfectly. He said, I don't do it because it's a different job. I said, different job? He said, yes, it's a different job. To have a mindset as a punter is a different job to being a mindset as a trainer. And you, in your case, you're an author, you're a publisher, you're an analyst. It's a different job to betting. And that's why psychologically I'm fascinated by betting. I'm not too sure whether or not you have to be totally obsessive of money and covet it, or whether you have to be emotionally divorced from it. So I'm forever thinking about the philosophy and the psychology of betting. But speaking personally, I'm not very good at it. I haven't lost money doing it. I've won money and I've had some very successful wins over the years, but I'm not good at it, which is why I love talking to people like Barney Curley, who is very good at it, and trying to see what the mindset is and what characteristics you need psychologically to be good at it. I'm not as good at it as I am, for instance, at analysing a complex handicap.
Okay, and at what point did the notion of becoming a man of the cloth go out the window?
It hasn't yet.
Okay, so you've become a successful advisory service and publisher, and you're a journalist in the time, so you've come to the point where you wanted to get into ownership. You went down the route, which some people might find quite surprising, which was unheard of at the time, was that you started a racing club and were a racing syndicate, and you had trouble with the jockey club, is that right?
Yes, well, I mean, despite my success commercially and professionally, I still didn't feel that I was comfortably off enough to own a horse in my own name. So I thought there was an opportunity to move beyond a partnership and a syndicate, which I'm not too sure in those days they existed in quite that way. There was a limit to how many people you could have in. And I thought, why don't we have a racing club? And I had no idea that I'd meet with such difficulties and obstacles in trying to form one. And I had to go down to, well, I don't know if it was Portman Square, but I had to go down to where the Jockey Club were located. And there was a table with six dignitaries, gentlemen, sat there. And the minute I walked through the door, because in those days I was bearded, long-haired, and looked like an extra for a heavy metal band. And I walked in and I sat there and I said I was very keen to start a racing club. They said, well, tell us what you're going to do. And I told them I had about 100 clients who wanted to have a share in a horse. They said, well, you've got to form a limited company. I said, why? They said, well, because that's how it's got to be. They've all got to be registered individually. and they've all got to be shareholders in the company. And everything I said was met with negativity and obstruction. In the end, I employed a solicitor, Matthew McCloy, who was a racing solicitor and knew all the ins and outs, and it took us something like 6 months to start it. There was only one other club at the time, Toby Balding ran one, which was similar, but it was structured in a different way. And to cut a long story short, we eventually started it 6 months down the line. 6 to 8 months. It took the best part of a year because I missed a couple of seasons when I wanted to buy a horse.
So you kicked the door down really then for, you know, it proliferates now, doesn't it?
It does, but in those days, racing was hugely elitist. For instance, when I started in the press box and I got a press badge, which I had to wait 2 years to get, I was the only independent owner of a press badge. They were reluctant to give me a press badge. And I promise you, in the first 3 to 6 months of being in the press box, only two journalists befriended me. The rest, I was shunned by the rest of them.
Yeah, I can imagine that. Now, you went on to own, manage, be in partnerships with over 60 winners. Some very high profile people. You can tell us a bit about those high profile people?
Yes, I suppose one of the highest profile, well, I'm a great lover like you of music, and any excuse to be around musicians, then I'll jump at it. And Mel Smith, the comedian, was on the ascendance in those days with Not the 9 o'clock News, which is a very popular satirical program. And he used to go racing, he used to love going racing, and I met him on a number of occasions, and I've never known anyone indulge themselves so much. We used to, I think I can share this now because he's no longer with us, bless him, but we used to go to Lingfield on the train, he used to buy from Barry Cope's Fish Bar a bottle of champagne after every race, most of which he drank. So if it was six races, he would have drunk about six bottles of champagne. And then we went to his home in Fulham, and there'd be narcotics of interest floating around. And then there'd be Bloody Marys. And then we'd look at teletext, and he'd ask me, he start betting again on the results, which I was privy to seeing on the teletext, and he then sat in the other room and went for it and started betting on the imaginary or racing that had taken place, which he'd missed in the evening. And somehow he managed to get himself up at 4 or 5 in the morning to do the recording for Not 9 o'clock News. And then we go off racing to Windsor. There was Mel Smith lived life to the full, and we always surprised how he'd survived. And then another great fan of my column, I shouldn't say fan, that sounds vain, but Steve Harley of Cockney Rebel wanted to meet me because he used to love horse racing, and he read the Sunday Times column, and I got to know him very well, and they both became owners. And my best friend to this day, N. Rytel, who's the voice of Spitting Image and a great mimic. And so one of the horses we had was called Cloudwalker. And he was owned, most members of Equity had a share in him at some point in their lives.
Now, also, another thing that you did was be a private handicapper for Mick Shannon. Now, what does that suggest, that the official ones make a lot of ricks? I mean, what's the main reason for employing a private handicapper?
Well, I was asked, this was many, many years later, this was quite recently, in the last few years. I mean, Mick Shannon, I don't follow football that closely, but he is one of the loveliest men you could ever wish to meet. He's wonderfully kind, hopelessly optimistic. And Matthew Tester, the BHA handicapper, set me up for the job, because Mick, to this day, overfaces many of his horses, but he gets away with it. He runs two-year-olds, maidens in listed black type races, get away with it, and Matthew felt he needed some help. And I had two very enjoyable years doing my best for him, but he didn't listen to a blind word I ever said, as far as I can see. And I was told that when he played football, he was not dissimilar. A lovely man. We got on very well. We had a lot of fun together. But in the end, he decided to do it his own way. I think I probably managed to place three or four horses for him. There was a horse in the nursery once, and he wanted to run this in a black type race. And I said, you'll win this nursery. You've got £10 in hand. And he listened to me on that occasion. But lovely man, lovely man.
Another string to your bow, you're a jockey's agent to Declan Murphy. So how did that come about, and how successful was it?
I was asked. Again, I don't go out soliciting work generally. I was asked to do it. Declan Murphy was riding for Josh Gifford and, more intriguingly, Barney Curley in those days. And he needed an agent. This was before there were agents. Dave Roberts wasn't around in those days. There weren't agents in the numbers there are now, where every jockey had an agent. But Barney said that Declan could do with one. So Declan came up to me one day at Cheltenham and said, Barney recommended me. So Barney must have known about me. I hardly knew Barney in those days, but he must have heard about me. And Declan came up to me and said, have you ever thought of being a jockey's agent? And I had huge respect for Declan and his riding style. He was a very patient jockey, just the sort of jockey I like. And he asked me to be his agent. And so we worked well together. And he's one of the great judges of this business. He always insisted Deep Sensation would win a Queen Mother Champion Chase. And I saw it getting beat in handicaps and everything. And he still said this horse will win a Queen Mother Champion Chase. And it duly did. And he became the inspiration for a book I wrote called Strictly Classified, Declan Murphy, when he spoke about the spirit of a horse and the psychology of a horse. I learnt an awful lot from him. And as a collateral benefit, I also worked a little bit with Barney and picked up gems from Barney, of course, during that time, as anyone would.
Well, Barney, tell us a bit more about him, because he's been my hero since I first got into racing.
He should be everyone's hero. I mean, the two words that sum him up are patience and discipline. That's the key to his betting. He's an enigmatic man. He's a very complex man. I've only chatted to him a few times, but he's unbelievably cool as well, and he looks the part. I remember once chatting to him at Windsor, and we were behind the stands, and I never make this mistake, but I did on this occasion. He had a horse running during the race that was about to go off, and he was standing there, and we were talking away, and his horse was running, and he still focused on talking to me while the race was happening 50 yards away. And I remember being with him at Ascot once, and we were talking beside the rails, and the rails bookmakers were lined there, and there was Mike Burton of Hills and Leslie Spencer and all those people that you're very familiar with, and he had his back to them all and was talking to me. So Barney was there talking to me there, and all the rails bookmakers were there, and Fred Binns and all the other bookmakers were standing there. And I said, I must leave you because, you know, I know you've got a horse running in a few minutes. He said, no, that's fine. Just keep talking. Just keep chatting away. So we kept chatting. We kept chatting. And whether he was using me anyway, and then he just literally turned round about a minute before the off and went click, 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 down the rails. What the click meant, I don't know, but he went click, 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 click. And how much money he had on that horse, I don't know, but he duly won. I think his name was Asaglawi. You may recall, because you were busy in those days working on the rails. You were probably there doing your footwork.
I don't think I was. I would have been there next to him eavesdropping if I was.
Well, what a wonderful man and an inspiration to me. And I just wish I had more access to him, as we all do.
Now, Barney Curley is like the rock star of horse racing.
Yes, good way of putting
it. Now, you've promoted to rock stars. You talked before about your friendship with Steve Harley, etc. You've promoted music gigs, Squeeze, Steve Harley, Is it important to have an interest outside of racing when you are so immersed in it?
I think it's important to have balance, yes. I mean, music is the most important thing, not person, the most important thing in my life, because it can elevate you to another place, and you need somewhere, rather than wallowing in despair at getting it wrong on the race course or being euphoric over the delight of it, it's good to have another safe haven to go to. Having said that, if you're anything less than totally focused in this business, then you'll be paying the price in some way or other. I'm not too sure of the relationship you should have with racing, whether it should be all-encompassing to the detriment of other personal aspects of your life and other areas of your life. But there can be great collateral damage in this business. I know a number of people whose relationships haven't survived who have been brilliantly successful at the job. But I think if you do have another interest, it does lead to balance, but I'm not too sure that you're going to be as good as you could be if you do have other interests. It must be all-encompassing, all-engrossing to some extent, and that can be exclusive and cut you out from the rest of the world and cut you out from the reality of the world. It's a hugely challenging, demanding business. I've always said about this business, in 50 years I've felt this, I've never known whether it's kept me sane or driven me mad, because I have been mad officially and I have been sane for most of my life, but it's one or the other. It's an extreme of some kind.
Martin, in the previous part, we got a little bit, you talked about you've been officially mad, and you talked about it in quite a glib sort of way, but you actually did have issues and had to spend a bit of time in the priory. Was that to do with the pressures of work or finding winners for people? Or is it, you know, what, can you put it down to anything?
Well, the nature of depressive illness, which is something that I've lived with and had to cope with and have embraced, really, is that there's a degree of sensitivity about it. And by being open and hugely receptive to everything I see in the racing world, I've also been witness to some things I prefer not to see. Spike Milligan, who worked with depressive people for most of his life and was himself a manic depressive, used to say depressive people have a layer of skin missing. So we're open and exposed to wonderful sites of great beauty, but we're also open to some of the darker sides of things. And there's a degree of sensitivity. And in my case, the thing that led to my time away, as I call it, was the pace of my life. I was thinking nothing of doing 50,000 miles a year in the car. I remember regularly logging up 50, 60,000 miles to get to a race course. I was with the Sunday Times. I had a business that was turning over £1 million a year when that was an awful lot of money. I didn't have time to take stock. I was an adrenaline junkie. I was hanging out with Mel Smith and people who'd been hugely successful in their own world. And I, in my case, got burnout. And I woke up one morning and I literally could not get dressed. For no apparent reason, I couldn't get dressed. I couldn't put my shoes on. I couldn't put my trousers on. I couldn't put my shirt on. And I didn't know what had happened. And I went to see my GP, who fortunately could see me, 2 hours later, when I had obviously got dressed. And then he got someone to see me 2 hours after that, 2 in the afternoon. And the man in black, that's how he seemed to me, he was wearing a dark suit, had come from Roehampton, the priory at Roehampton. And he said, we need you. We need you to come and stay with us for a while. I said, I can't, it's a Cambridge show on Saturday. And he said, no, you need to come. I said, well, can I come next week? He said, no, now. He said, you must come now. You need time away. And on and off for the next 6 months, I totally burnt out. And I hadn't recognised it myself, but he did, and the GP had. And that went through then the most enlightening experience of my life.
So was, when you recovered, was there a point when you had recovered and they, was it safe to sort of jump straight back in? With that, was there not a danger of the same thing repeating itself, or did you learn lessons from it and change the way you sort of lived?
That's a good question. I learned lessons from it in respect of my relationship with others. It's something that I've learned to live with, and you don't really recover from it as much. I mean, that you, there's medication and there's therapy, and they're the two things that work together to help guide you through life. But I consider it to have been a gift. I'm not going to be someone who's going to, I don't want violins out over this. I consider it to be a gift because it enables me to see things that perhaps other people don't see. And I've turned it into a positive, and we're in a room sitting here at the moment where the majority of the books are on what's called mental illness, though I hate that expression. I hate that phraseology. But we're surrounded with books here on self-help and dealing with depressive illness. It's a way of shining, despite it being called depression and the darkness, it's a light shining on the world around you. So I'm hugely privileged to have undergone that. And the joke was, in the Priory, us depressives had a great time. The addicts who lived in the other end of town, in the Priory, they had to go to sessions all the time and were miserable. We had a load of fun. I mean, I can share this little thing with you. We had open nights on Thursday, and we also thought we better put an act on for the guests. So we all put sheets on togas and started quoting Shakespeare like mad people out the windows. So the punters had something. And then when they all went home, we sat back and had coffee. We had a lot of fun there.
Yeah, there's a positive as well. You've extra positive you've taken out of it. You've trained to be a counsellor. Is that because of, I assume,
yeah,
your experiences?
Yeah, I wanted to give it some structure, what I'd gone through. And it's something which, I mean, having three daughters and seven grandchildren and a very large family, there's opportunities for the counselling to hopefully be productive and helpful. But I haven't officially trained as a counsellor. I've helped a couple of people unofficially. But yes, I did a course in counselling, which I'm not totally sure I should be involved with now because it's too close and personal.
Now, when you came back from that, was there still a business there to pick up again, or did you have to start from scratch again?
That was the extraordinary thing. My clients stayed with me. I wasn't running the business, but I had a team around me in those days. The business was then based in Ascot in Sunningdale High Street. And the team kept it going, and I delegated the job. I was still finding, I remember during that time, Dermot Weld with Vintage Crop won the Melbourne Cup, and I was let out one day. We had let outs, and I was let out to a friend's house, and I saw the Melbourne Cup was being, I think it was a week later, and I saw Vintage Crop was there. I said, oh, that'll win. And then I went back to the Priory, and that was enough for them all to send out Vintage Crop to the clients. So we were encouraged to keep away from our regular work when we were at Roehampton.
But were you allowed to watch Vintage Crop win? Did you get up and burn the midnight oil to see it win the Melbourne Cup?
No television. Not allowed.
No, just the final thing on this subject. You say you woke up and you found yourself unable, you know, in a bad way, unable to sort of even function, get up, get dressed.
Yeah.
Looking back on it, are there any warning signs that in hindsight people should maybe look out for before they get to that position?
In my case, I never saw it coming. I had no idea. It was a total shock to me. I was so high on my business and success that I didn't see it coming. But having said that, I see it in others sometimes, but in a subliminal way. I see people sometimes who I think it's not because of what they do, it's because of what they are. It's not a doing thing, it's a being thing. It's ontological, to use the correct word, ontos logos, from the Greek, to do with being. And I sometimes see someone who I think is at risk. And it's in their eyes, their manner, just a little throwaway remark every so often. One of the dangerous things is if you see someone who appears indifferent. Because if they're in love or they hate something, that's an extreme. It's a passion. To hate is as much a passion as to love. But if they're indifferent, it means they've lost interest. There was a wonderful line in Cheers once where someone said, we all know the opposite of love isn't hate, it's indifference. And you occasionally see that.
Now, it was interesting because I've been reading your book on the mentality of horses, and you've got a lot of quotes in there.
Yeah.
Have you got a lot of quotes? Do you go to these quotes sometimes for...
I find them great comfort, yes. I mean, one of the best ones is, coincidences is God's way of staying anonymous. I love that one. That's Einstein, of all people. There's no road so long that has no turning. Dick Hearn told me that once during a losing run, Major Dick Hearn, the trainer. There's only two things in life, fear and love. And I think that's a good one, because most actions that people get involved with, or most behaviour, mannerisms, are love or fear based. You can trace, especially with racehorses, I sometimes see a horse and I think, oh, this is a love-based upbringing, or with people. It's this person had a love-based upbringing or a fear-based upbringing. Not love and hate, it's love and fear.
Okay, Martin, this is the bit where we educate everybody, including me.
Oh dear, oh dear.
So you've been successful for 50 years.
So on, and off, on and off.
On and off for 50
I've had
years.
My moments.
Well, we'll call it success for 50 years. So just the nitty-gritty of things now. You've still got thousands of clients. You've still got all these all this work that you do. So how much time would you spend on the form book a day?
I wouldn't describe it as working on the form book, but I see in some shape or form at some point every single race that's run in England and Ireland, and Britain and Ireland, thanks to having access to the channels. It's not as good as the old days when I could get to a race meeting and take in the whole, every aspect of a horse, its demeanour beforehand in the paddock and stuff like that. And we are subject to the whatever the pundits want us to hear and see. But I may not be watching racing from first thing in the morning till last thing at night, but I will record it. For instance, during this time now, I've put on the record facility so that I can just fast forward through. So I used to say I spend 70 hours a week. That used to be my stock answer to it, which is about 10 hours a day. But I'm always aware of racing. I'm always conscious of it happening, and I will see it at some point. As studying the form book, that's subject to the services I'm producing. So if I'm writing, for instance, about Cheltenham, then for the 2 or 3 weeks before that, I'm carefully looking at the form and seeing how it builds up. And a race evolves. It's not something you just do the night before. If you do that, if you get hit by the racing post, and I say hit because you're receptive to what they're going to send you, all the features and everything come over and they get in the way and they cloud your judgment. That's why I believe that one of the ethos of my business is to focus on horses which have certain attributes, the ability to win, the ability to quicken, enthusiasm, tenacity and stuff like that. So I write to order depending on the publications we're doing, but it's not something I just do the night before. The race has evolved over a period of time, For instance, in a classic case, the Derby and Oaks, it will have evolved from the, in my case, from the following, the previous summer. And gradually a shape emerges.
So would you, do you even like watch the all-weather racing at Kempton and Lingfield?
I love the all-weather racing more than anything. That's where all the naughty stuff happens.
Now, obviously, if you've been doing it for 50 years, so you're watching a race, is it come naturally now to you to evaluate what's going on? Is it like riding a bike? You sort of watch a race and you know what you're looking for. And...
Yes, we alluded to this earlier with the sensitivity thing. The point is you've got to be receptive to what's happening. But something I do, a little trick which may be of interest to people, is when I watch racing, I turn the sound off. That's not being disrespectful to the commentators who attain a very high standard of achievement these days in how they do it compared with years ago. But you get distracted, and rather like the blind man hears more, the deaf man sees more, by depriving yourself of one of those senses, you pick up more. So when I watch racing, as you witnessed earlier, I'll have the sound off, and then I'll see a race take shape.
And do you ever get, do you ever give it the eye when one wins? Or
no.
Is it too clinical now?
No, not now. I did when I had my first winner as an owner, when Cloudwalker won at Wolverhampton on the flat, on the old turf track. I couldn't contain myself. I ran, almost fell over, jumping down the stands. But no, I don't get emotionally involved with it anymore as much as I did. There are occasions, just very seldom.
Now, I ask all successful punters and form students especially, so you're going to be no exception. What is it that you see that other people don't see that makes you more formidable at analysing form?
I don't know, but I do see things at the race course. There's a coming together, is the best way of putting it, of events. There's a horse there that attracts my eye, and I don't know why. It's this intangible stuff. There'll be, I'll see him in the pre-paddock, or her in the pre-paddock, and there's something about its eye, its demeanour, its manner, which attracts me. The key is to be totally devoid of self. No ego. You mustn't allow prejudice and pre-formulated ideas to cloud your vision. The thing is to be totally receptive to what you see, and you think, that's interesting, what's Sheikh Hamdan doing here at Nottingham on a Wednesday? Not that that would happen, but there were days, I can assure you, where certain owners would turn up. You know this from your days working in the ring. I know, for instance, you mentioned before, it's not the amount of money someone has on it, who it is, and this happened from Reg Akehurst's wife. When she went up to the ring and had a five on one of Reg's horses, it meant more than someone coming in with a few grand. And so when I go to a race, I go to the pre-paddock. I'm always just ahead of the crowd. They go into the paddock. Then you go, in the old days, you went to the ring and you saw the right people were there or they weren't there. And then you see the horse go down to post. Then you see it in the race, and it's a coming together of all these things. But the key, I think, is my receptiveness, how open I am. I'm totally devoid of anything getting in the way of what is happening around me. It's an intangible thing. It's hard to describe. I could say some obvious things like, oh, the way the horse sticks its neck out, or when it races, or other could talk about stuff like that. But it's not that. It's something else happening. I'm loath to use the word, but it's almost a spiritual experience.
Would you devoid yourself of the market as well before coming to a conclusion about a race? Would you
the betting market?
Yeah. Would you?
Oh, massive, massively important. No, I wouldn't. I take that in as well. I'll take in every single thing that could be.
Before you went to the paddock or afterwards, if you were looking at something, you want to clear your mind of any outside.
Well, in the old days before Betfair. Because, of course, Betfair now dominates everything. But in the old days before Betfair, I'd know roughly what sort of price should be, and I think, hang on, this should be a 6-4 shot. Why is it 7-2? This should be a 7-2 shot. Why is it 6-4? Or certain bookmakers, John Banks pushing one out when everyone is 6-4 and he's pushing to 13-8. Yeah, it's picking up. The vibe in the rails in those days was hugely significant. Ladbrokes, what they were backing. If Cyril was backing one for Ladbrokes at Windsor in the old days, these are names which go back a few years, of course. But
now, doing my research, one thing that I was, you know, there's so much. For example, the sleeper section, the clock watcher, the anti-post agenda, under the radar, the weekend action, the update. Just six of the things you offer your thousands of clients you've still got.
You have worked hard.
Where do you find the time? How can you possibly be enough hours in the day to write all those words even?
Well, I worked out recently, I used to do 1 million words a year, and it's now a few hundred thousand, but it's less. It's the old adage and cliche, it's down to teamwork. I've got a very good team of people who aren't well known, not big names, but people who have achieved a very high level of intuitive, insightful skills. And so they bring horses to my attention every so often. I've got a couple of people, for instance, who text me when they see a horse of interest, and I trust their judgment. There are some exceptionally fine racing brains out there. There are some people who never have a racing brain. I mean, one of the things that I distrust very much these days is statistics. There's a lot of statistics out there in the Racing Post, and there's a lot of pundits who say, oh, well, this train is 2 from 20 here at Kempton, or this. I don't go by that too much. So, but yes, yeah, so sorry, to answer your question, I've got a very good team of people to support me and bring my notice to things, but I pick up a lot of stuff myself. And also, I'm not afraid to say nothing. I say, sorry, there's nothing this week, or there's nothing today. And I hope my clients respect me for that. I'm not going to just think, oh, I must find a horse for them because it's a Saturday. That's why, for example, the best thing of the day may be running a Sedgefield on a Tuesday. It may be the best bet of the week. But because it's Sedgefield on a Tuesday and it's not the King George at Ascot on a Saturday, I'm not going to tip a horse in a big race simply because it's a big race. If I see value, especially, and it's consistent with what people expect me of, they think, oh, hang on, what's this? Martin's dug one out in a selling plate at Fakenham on a Boxing Day. That's what they expect of me, but that's what I like doing anyway.
You've been successful as an advisory service for 50 years, as we've said. Now, is that a big part of how you've actually kept ahead of the game? Because it's always changing, isn't it? So keeping ahead of it for that long must be quite a job.
Yes, it is, especially with the way technology moves on. I mean, we've got clients, for example, who've been hugely successful professionals. Rebecca, my daughter, who runs my office, tells me that we got ex-lawyers and solicitors and doctors who've actually knocked it on the head to respond to the opportunities now presented in the betting market with Betfair, with arbitrage and trading. Which I enjoy myself. If I got 20-1 anti-post about a horse, then I'll cover my stake on the principle that the most important thing is you don't lose. So we move with the times. My business moves with the times, and I'm not particularly au fait or conversant with modern technology, but fortunately Rebecca and my other team, members of my team, on Twitter all the time and using social media, and they're familiar with it, so they have an advantage over me there. We've been very successful. I don't want to sound immodest, but we've been very successful at maintaining the traditional values of integrity and authenticity and congruence with moving with the modern times and using technology as a vehicle to pass that through, to pass that on, to maintain those principles.
Should winning money be less important than enjoying the thrill of the chase, if you like, in the horse racing game?
Well, it depends how
important. But I love horse racing. I love going racing. I've been in it all my life. But that is how it's now. I don't think I could ever be as good as the people that mark my card. So am I missing out, or should I just be happy to have the knowledge coming in?
Well, I've often wondered with my clients why they get in touch with me. Is it because they want to win money or not? Is it because they want to be involved with somebody? There are people out there, for example, who believe in employing what they can deem to be a professional in any walk of life. And they, I personally enjoy the journey. And in a bizarre, perverse way, I do quite enjoy the pain of failure. Because the thing about this game is you're never totally in charge of it. So there is going to be an emotional involvement. But we all know about the occasions where I used to think, for instance, talking to somebody who hasn't had the last leg of a Yankee go down isn't a complete person. there's a kind of pain that this takes you through. So that if you've worked hard burning the midnight oil on a Wokingham handicap and you get done on the line because the jockey didn't get a clear run 2 furlongs out, it's painful, and it somehow enables you to, emboldens you to enable to cope with all the problems you're going to meet in life. I think it's made me battle hardened. So as opposed to just sending off £5 for a news sheet or a bulletin book or £10 for one of my Dark Horses annuals, I think the journey, the emotional journey, is important as well. And that is that can only really be shared with, that can only really be endured, enjoyed, whatever you want to, however you want to describe it, if you've gone through the whole process of following a race through from the entry stage through to the overnight stage through to the race itself. So it's a painful journey, it's a pleasurable journey, but it is a journey, and you're never in charge.
I think that's a perfect way to end the interview. Martin Julian, thank you very much.
Absolute pleasure.
Star Sports TV, our weekly magazine TV programme packed with tips, news and banter on the key sports events of the week. Check out the latest episode at starsportsbet.co.uk, begambleaware.org. Over 18 only.